So we're online with Znor.
Nice.
Hey, David.
Hey, how's it going, man? I hope you don't mind being recorded.
Or are we being recorded?
Yeah, but <course. laughs> but well, we were being recorded by the NSA, and you were being recorded by me. But I don't have that special thing where I can use just code words and skip to any part.
All right. Yeah. 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 No, that's cool.
Okay.
So, just to kind of set us off in the direction, based upon what David was saying there, I think it's funny. I recently posted a thing on Facebook. Well, it was like a couple weeks ago now. And what I put was like, you know how in the Alcoholics Anonymous model, how like everyone has a sponsor and then they also sponsor someone else, but it's not a cyclical thing. Like your sponsor is one person, and then the person who sponsors you is somebody else altogether. All right, you sponsor someone else, right? So it's not a direct connection. Like you won't necessarily know who your sponsor's sponsor is. Right? And your sponsor doesn't necessarily know who you might be the sponsor to.
It's like that cell system in the Battle of Algiers.
Yes.
Have you seen that movie? Yeah.
Well, no, I haven't actually, but now I'm very interested. But here's the thing. So I've developed this theory that this is what we, like, let's just assuming that, you know, and there's this really interesting play by Samuel Beckett that kind of confirms this, that everything that's political in the world, whatever it is, all these political plays and shit like that, all these political things that are happening, what they're really about is the attempt for human beings to try to make contact with consciousness.
Dude, I have to say just really quickly, because this is a sink, is that my rabbi, about 3 hours ago, we were talking about Ralph Cramden and the Honeymooners, and he said, God, that show must have been written by Samuel Beckett.
That makes sense. Sure, because it's people in the dark. And, you know, I was thinking about this in terms of, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Joseph P. Farrell.
Yeah, a little bit.
I have not read a single thing by this guy. But I heard a short splice from an interview, and he started talking about how the plays of Shakespeare and the Bible were actually poking fun at a character named Titus or Titus from history.
Oh, sure.
Oh, do you know about that?
Yeah.
Do you mind filling in?
Yeah, it's because, Joseph Atwell popularized the idea with his Caesar's Messiah. And he extrapolates lots of things. His probability usage with mathematics is incredible, and it's the best part of the book. But scholars for years have taken Antiquity of the Jews and War of the Jews by Josephus Flavius and compared them to the New Testament in all kinds of ways. And one of those ideas that's emerged from that is that the New Testament is actually a satirical play on Titus Caesar, who's taking over Jerusalem at the time, 2,000 years ago. And it's a huge subject to get into.
Let's just say that there's this there. Okay. Well, one of the things that I have found, you know, I don't know, you guys are familiar with the term cultural Marxism, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we should talk about that. That gets bandied about all over the place now.
Here's the thing. I think it actually has a meaning that is directly associated to this whole Titus thing. And it's Titus is the correct pronunciation.
That's true. Although I like to say Titus, but yeah.
Titus. I don't know why. I think that might be important. Like Titus.
Oh yeah. No, I wrote a blog about.
I don't know whether it's important or not. I worry that it might be, so I try to be as close to historically accurate as I can.
Right.
But here's the thing. What I'm thinking is this. You know, in Shakespeare, there's this phrase: "All the world's a stage, and in it we are only players." All right? Well, one of the things that I think that this statement, which is incredibly pervasive in regards to the way we think about ourselves metaphysically, what I'm considering with this statement now for the first time, having heard this little clip about Titus and how the Elizabethans essentially were creating this kind of platform to thumb their noses at another philosophy of existence, right? Essentially. So, what I'm thinking is this. So we have all, now, as far as I'm concerned, Francis Bacon is the author of the King James Bible and also of Shakespeare. And to me, that's not a conspiracy theory. It's so fucking obvious, it's insane. But that's another matter. There may be other contributors, like obviously De Vere and stuff like that, and there may have been another female contributor. I've seen interesting evidence. But the Bacon evidence is so thick.
Sure.
You know, you can literally make a fucking McMuffin from it.
Yeah, there's a chapter about that in Manly P. Hall's The Secret Teachings of All Ages, where there's actually a flap that he has where you can see transparently an image that was done of Francis Bacon that goes way back, overlaid with an image of Shakespeare.
And, yeah, yeah.
But there's right. that, but then there's his whole explanation in the chapter. It's incredible.
Well, I haven't read that, but
that is a good chapter.
Here's a bit of trivia for you guys. Did you know that the term bard in the time of Shakespeare was actually used to describe a side of bacon? A bard was a certain cut. It was a pork belly, right? It was a side of bacon.
Yeah.
And they called it a sweet bard because it had all that fat in it, so it made it sweeter to the taste.
This shit's not kosher, but yeah.
Oh, well, that's another that is another incredibly important. I don't even want to go there because then we're into Soylent Green territory, basically, literally.
But eating it stops the archons from taking over your mind.
Does it?
Yeah, this is according to John Lash, right?
Well, I think it could potentially be the reverse. See, that's always the thing, right? I mean, what would the archons? I mean, the archons are supposedly intelligent, and something tells me they're more intelligent than John Lash. it's just a one level reverse psychology, right? We want those fuckers eating bacon because we want to eat their minds, right? And the worms ate into their brain. You know, it's just, and it goes on forever. But I can't even remember what we're talking about anymore.
It is.
Oh yeah. So I just like that idea that in terms of the whole so-called cultural Marxist thing, which is. Very much, and De Boer talked about this as the so-called spectacle too, right? The philosopher Guy Debord.
Right.
And I'm not like a De Boerian, I'm not a Marxist, but I think he's like, in terms of just representative of the model, I see what they're getting at. What they're basically saying is, look, you know, there's this way in which we've all become something where we're constantly looking at ourselves as if we're being looked at by other people. So our actions automatically become schismatic that way.
Right.
And that makes us, as human beings, a whole fuckload easier to rule, essentially. And also, more importantly, to organize. All right? Because if we're talking about Elizabethan, then we're going into John Dee and all that other shit, and the so-called Enochian crap, and like obviously breaking out of this matrix, whatever that means. So I just think that's kind of interesting in those terms. But when I'm thinking of cultural Marxism now, I'm seeing how closely and beautifully it relates to the ideas inside of Shakespeare. Like, oh, here we are. Look, we're creatures. We're beautiful creatures on the stage, and we're being watched, and we're watching ourselves. And the idea of being a person, living an existence that is metaphysically precisely the same as being on a stage is exactly 1984. That's what it is.
Sure.
That's the end of it, right?
Right.
It's, yeah. Panopticon, right?
Yeah. So there you go. Yep. I mean, it was very interesting. I was just listening to that clip from Ferrell, and I thought, oh, I see how all this works together perfectly in terms of drama. And to me, you know, and this is one of the things that's made very nicely by Kubrick, obviously in Eyes Wide Shut, is that basically, you know, you're going and you're putting on, you know, the costumer slash customer is always right. So you go in there, you put on your costume. And that's what it's really all about. It's just a costume experience, and that underneath we are all nothing, we're empty. And to me, this all fits in with this new age concept that we should abandon our egos as well.
Right.
Which
right.
is, you know, so I'm just fascinated by how all this fits together.
Dude, Vladimir Nabokov, pronounced that right? So he was the first person to translate Alice in Wonderland into German, I believe.
That wouldn't surprise me.
I have this whole thing with this. So if you watch Funeral Parade of Roses.
Oh, I know what you're talking about, David.
You know what I'm talking about? We're painting the roses red, the fucking sacrifice off with their heads.
Yes.
Funeral Parade of Roses, in terms of sacrifice, you have this whole Oedipal thing, obviously. But the idea of what's being communicated in Greek tragedy from like Nietzsche's perspective, it's a big thing to get into. I wanted to tell you, Znor, I got really inspired. And I played Magical Mystery Tour, followed by Her Majesty's Satanic Request with Funeral Parade of Roses. And it actually, it blew me the fuck away. And I actually, really? It sounds weird, but I had a whole rationale for doing that in terms of the release dates of the albums. You know, that the film Magical Mystery Tour, they started filming 9/11, I forget what year. But December 8th of, also I forget what year, the EP of Magical Mystery Tour was released the same day as Her Majesty's Satanic Request. And, you know, the Scarab pushing the dung ball, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones always playing off of each other. But there's a phenomenal thing that actually happens when you do that. I'd recommend it. I was telling Mark that the only reason I haven't edited them together and uploaded them yet is because of the subtitle factor with my Adobe Premiere. I just don't want to type out all the subtitles and do them each individually because it's fucking a monotonous, crazy process. I don't know. It seems like this sacrificial rite and what's being communicated with A Clockwork Orange and that are really, they really get to the heart of things.
That sounds excellent. Have you ever seen the Pasolini movie of Oedipus Rex?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't.
The director for Funeral Parade of Roses based a lot of that movie on Oedipus Rex.
Did he?
Like he took inspiration from that, yeah. He was a big Pasolini fan.
Interesting. Super interesting. So that's the thing. So these guys are playing off of each other with their films.
Right.
You got Kubrick, obviously, A Clockwork Orange. Although visually and in a lot of different symbolic ways, it's obviously connected with your... I mean, I heard your argument for that, and it's really strong. And at the same time, you can see the him responding to the film If. Are you familiar with that?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And then you can see that Oh Lucky Man was a response to A Clockwork Orange, overtly so, admittedly so.
Almost the same movie.
Right,
yeah.
And so...
It's kind of... It's almost like it's turned inside out, as it were.
Yeah, it's just they're running on the same theme. It's like they have this theme of what they're trying to get at, and then they're like, go from another angle, you know?
This is exactly how you create a matrix or the concept of a matrix. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Zner, because I want to hear what you got to say, but let me just say this briefly, that like if we're talking about, say, creating a holographic, and I'll just use that as a, what better term could I come up with right now, but I know there's a lot of problems with that, but we would need cameras or projectors happening, you know, inside of a sphere in as many positions as possible to create a convincing central holographic image, right?
Sure.
Well, so this is exactly what... Now, with these types of occult connections in media, and this is why I think that media that is entertainment is far more reliable to examine for truth than news media or anything else, because there's no dispute. They're not going to change that album, and somebody's got that album out there somewhere. They got that original one, you know?
Sure.
So it's always going to be out there, so it's always the same every time, right? So if there's an implication that there could be an actual program being made here, and that these media events are carefully orchestrated to go with each other, to create the concept that we are living inside a matrix that is convincing on a subconscious level, but maybe... In fact, we're not. Maybe the whole thing is just a trick, right, to keep us kind of maybe servile or something like that. I don't know. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah. It's it's a problem of our own perception, right?
Go on.
The whole Blake thing once again, right? It's we limit ourselves by our own perception, and the way out of that is through double vision, right? Which you are able to see the false matrix, but able to see eternity at the same time.
Yes, yeah. Which is actually, interestingly enough, David, that's exactly what Zizek says when he's talking about the Matrix movies. He says, you know, it's not enough that there's a pill that can make you see the Matrix, but instead what you really need is a pill that can make you see how the reality and the Matrix are married to each other in a way that neither are necessarily aware of. So it's that kind of thing.
Right. The third pill, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
The purple pill.
I don't think it could be purple, though. I mean, the purple may be neutral. White, possibly.
Possibly, yeah, yeah.
That's another frightening.
Interesting.
So, Znor, while you dialed in,
uh-huh.
I mean, I'm kind of having a friendship connection here with David, which we've never really kind of had before.
I disagree, but okay.
Well, no. I feel like we've had it, but it was always under the auspices of a previously existing official event. Like, Like, you know, tonight you just called me up to talk, right, without any necessary pre-existing pretense.
Right.
So, you know, that's cool. And for me, that's something that's very special. So because of that, I was actually telling him the story of, which I haven't told to anybody. I haven't told it to any of you guys yet, about what really happened to me with my 2001 thing and why I'm why I believe I know for a fact, and I didn't get to this point with David when you dialed in, but why I know for a fact that the MK Ultra is a real thing, and that and Manchurian candidates are absolutely real, because I have been one. Like, I refer to myself as a Manchurian suicide, essentially, because what happened to me was, and I was telling David about how I was up in this place, and I kind of went into this with you a bit too, Snor. Like, I was up in the north, and then this kid said to me, have you ever heard of this thing where you sync up, you know, he didn't say sync. I don't know if he did. It's just this kid, the skateboarder kid. We were talking about movies, and he was moved by my passion for film. And as I said to David earlier, at that time in 2001, in summer 2001, prior to my event, I would now look back upon that saying I had no fucking idea what I was talking about anything, period. I mean, I had thought, and I knew that too. I did know it. I had thoughts, but I didn't really have any framework of reality, right, in which I was living. Everything was a great big mystery to me. And I kind of, you know, I look back and I kind of wonder if maybe I wish it was still a big mystery. But now it's a big stinking mystery. but anyway, so the point of the matter is, so this kid says to me, have you ever synced up, you know, Wizard of Oz with Dark Side of the Moon? And I don't know if you know this, David, but at that time, I had never listened to the album Dark Side of the Moon. I had only ever heard radio play tracks, stuff like that. I had never listened to a single album by... to me, that's what makes this, for me, very precious, is the nakedness of this thing, right? I had no idea what I was going to be in for. And as I was also saying to David, I was very unsophisticated in 2001. In the first half of 2001, anyway, I turned that page very quickly on one terrible day, but I'll get to that very briefly. So what happens is this, you know, I don't have a computer. I've never heard of anything like this in my life, right? I've never heard, well, listen to this album and watch this movie. Nothing like that has ever crossed my mind. And apparently it was becoming a bit of an internet phenomenon by this time in early 2001. I don't know if you guys had heard of it by then, but anyway, maybe you hadn't, whatever. But the point of the matter is that I was fucking fascinated. I thought, geez, that sounds like a shitload of fun, right? You know? So, the long story short is that nobody in this town, a population of 60, had a copy of the movie, The Wizard of Oz. And there was this girl who lived in town. She was actually the wife of the mayor of this town, the mayor and the coroner. He did both of these things. Chief coroner and mayor of Beaver Creek Town 60. You know? And it was an important job because there's a lot of accidents on the Alaska Highway. And whenever he was the nearest guy, they'd have to send him out and he'd look at the bodies. And then the cars are all still stacked up there in a car graveyard. This is an incredibly weird town. It, literally in the middle of nowhere. And I mean that actually literally, not the so-called virtually literally. So it turned out she had a copy of 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I literally turned to the guy and I said this. I said, this is before I found out that she had a copy. I said, you know, she doesn't have a copy of The Wizard of Oz. But you know what? We could do it with 2001 A Space Odyssey. They're basically the same movie. And this thought came out of my mouth spontaneously. I had no thought of it. And I thought, oh, geez, that's kind of interesting. And I realized immediately what I was latching onto and why. Because I was a lounge piano player up there, right? I did a show, but I also played while they were eating dinner and sang songs. And one of the songs I did often was the song called The Green, Green Grass of Home. And it references all these colors, the ruby lips, the golden hair, and the green grass. And I related this to the color of the spaceship suits in 2001, I thought, geez, there's something there. Maybe there's a connection there, right? But I wasn't thinking in the kind of advanced way or with any foundation of the sort of stuff that we do now, right? None of it. So we do this sync up, and there were 15 or 20 people that sat and watched the film, and they were literally on their feet, jumping up and down. They couldn't believe it. And I became obsessed with this. I looked at it over and over and over again, hundreds of times. And then what happened to me, and this is where I usually stop telling the details of the story, because here's what happened. First of all, I heard on the radio, I was listening to a radio broadcast. There was no TV up there, right? So I was listening to a radio broadcast. One guy had satellite TV, but I mean the hotel itself and in the room that I had, there's no TV. So I would listen to the radio, you know, pass time. And the day before I did this, I heard this person talking about transcendental meditation. And one of the things the radio broadcaster actually said was, the interviewer asked, so are there any side effects, the bad things that might happen because of transcendental meditation? And the first thing out of the radio person's mind was, well, people might try to kill themselves if they do this. And I thought, oh, yeah, whatever. You know, right? So it's the next day now, and I'm doing TM while looking at this movie. And I get up and I start walking around in the staff recreation area, which I have literally driven people out of. If they know I'm there, they don't even come there anymore, because they know I'm listening to they know I'm, first of all, stoned out of my gourd. I had this huge bomb, which I called Excalibomb. And I was like, and I was drinking too, but the way I was drinking was this, tiny little sips every few minutes for days on end. I hadn't slept in days. I was in the happiest state of my life, and this is a very important point, is that I was in no way depressed or feeling down or anything like that. And then what happened was I looked down at my socks on my feet, and it was right at the time, it's in the song, is it Brain Damage, where the black and blue, no...
Mm. Black. Yeah. No, that's Us and Them, but yeah.
Us and Them, yeah. And I looked down and I was wearing one dark blue sock and one black sock, but I didn't know this when I put them on in the morning because they were so close in color. And it was right where I was hearing the lyric, who knows which is which or who is who.
It's
right?
Funny because my Skype screen goes from black to blue. It like fades in, this version of Skype. Yeah, anyways. it's funny because I'm looking right at that, yeah.
Because this is what I'm doing. I'm sitting here, and I look down at my feet, and I see that, and I take this as a clue, right? And what made it worse was that I looked outside the window, and there was just this crow sitting there.
Oh, yes. Is that Salem's Lot? Or no. What's that one? The Stand.
That's The Omen. It's The Omen.
Oh, well, there's that too. But in The Stand, it's a crow that keeps on showing up, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay. It's also the raven, right?
The only creature that I've ever killed is a crow. And it was in Beaver Creek, next to this hill called Red Hill, which has a lot of crows on it. And this crow had been hit by a car. And it was badly injured. And I picked up a rock and I broke its skull open. It's the only thing I've ever killed in my life was a crow, except for bugs and stuff like that. And I don't do that often, but that's beside the point. So I looked at that crow, and it seemed to be saying to me, you need to do this now, right? And it seemed like a message. And I became convinced at this moment that I was receiving messages. Now, I told you there's no TV up there, right? But but in the staff rec room, they had this satellite hookup. So I turned on the TV to try and distract myself. And there was an apple was the first thing I saw on the screen. And the apple had a worm in it. And it was saying, and I saw the green and the red together. And I immediately got this message. I don't know where I was getting this message from. Like, is this psychosis, right? That I needed to consume the red and the green together, like the apple, right?
Merry Christmas.
So, yeah, I saw this apple, and I needed to take a bite of this apple, even though I knew it had a worm in it. Well, what was I going to eat for the apple, and what was going to be the apple, and what was going to be the worm? Well, I happened to have a bag with almost 2 ounces of very tightly compressed marijuana in it. Because my brother was sending it up to me, and he was pushing it into these little candles, and it was really, really tight. It would take hours for it to actually expand so that you could smoke it in a joint or something like that. And I looked at this weed, of which there was almost 2 ounces, and I had this chewable vitamin C, which was red in color. I put the two together, and I started eating it, and I ate those 2 ounces of weed in about maybe 5 minutes.
Oh no!
And then I started to meditate. I started to hum, and a movie came on the TV, and it was I had the TV on because at the time I was also listening to the album Kid A, the Radiohead. Everything all the time. Leave it on. Yeah. Everything all the time. And I heard this as a mantra in my mind. Leave it on. Everything all the time. So I didn't turn anything off. Anything more. Right. So I live, the TV's just on there. I'm not even looking at it, and I'm meditating. And what I can't remember what. Oh yeah, the movie All the Pretty Horses came on, and all I saw was the title, ATHP, All the Pretty Horses, ATPH, and I immediately said this: the path. I saw the word path jump out at me, and I felt that I needed to follow this path. So by following the path, I went over the TV, and there was this disc sitting there. Somebody had left like a CD of some rap music, and I began to read each and every title of the tracks. And this is where the story gets really interesting, really fucking fast, all right? Because I'm having so much fun right now. I felt like fucking Peter Pan on an adventure, literally. That's how I felt. Everything was beautiful and magical. I was so happy. I was getting paid a fucking fortune. I was in great shape. I mean, you know, I felt like my life was perfect. Now, I was the opposite of what I am now. A broken down, overweight burnout, essentially, right? So I look at, I'm reading down these titles, and I realized one by one, it was the story of my life. Mm-hmm. Every title related perfectly to all these things that had happened. And then finally it got up to a title and it said, A Bullet Through the Head was the last.
Oh, no.
Yes. So I went back and I read them over slowly again, and I said, okay. I said, it's a bullet through the head for me. So I need to do something about this. I felt that I needed to act immediately. And there's more detail to this that I, you know, but I felt like I was being told. I said, the black and blue socks, it was one step after another, led to this point. You could call it psychosis. And it occurred to me in my mind at that moment, I needed to hang myself, and I needed to do it instantly. And there could be no moment of thought about it, because if I showed any fear, then my calamity would be much, much worse. So this is what I did. I hung myself. And I still have a scar that goes all the way around my neck, showing, I think I told you and Bill that last time I talked to you, Snor, that showing where this rope, I used, like as I told you guys, I've been a mountaineer. So I used a type of a knot called the clove hitch. And it's actually a figure eight, interestingly enough, that you fold over and it tightens on itself. And it continues to tighten up to 2,000. And I went unconscious on this rope, and I have no idea how I got off of it. And the next thing I remember, I was laying on this couch, and this guy, who I have no idea was just saying, you just need to drink a lot of water. And there was a pitcher of water, and it was filled with dead mosquitoes in front of me. And I had no idea who this guy was. He stood with his back to me, all right? And I was laying on this couch moaning. I could barely breathe because my throat was constricted so tightly. And I was going in and out of consciousness. And oh, I want to, the one other thing that I'll tell you that made me make do this decision is because I started looking at the Kubrick stare. Because I was watching 2001 over and over and over again, right? This is the thing that pushed me over the edge. I did the Kubrick stare. I went up to a mirror, and I put my head, my forehead against the mirror, and then I did the Kubrick stare. I stared up with my eyes, and everything went black, man. It was fucking wild. It was like 360-degree total blackness, right? It was fantastic. So I felt like I had a connection of some kind there. I don't know what it was. But anyway, so yeah, I hung myself, and I nearly died. And I was immediately declared to be insane. And they've, you know, that's where, the way my life has been. I lost everything, my job, my friends. Because, and you know why? I lost everything because I refused to believe when they told me that this was just some kind of episode. Right? Mm. Because I had seen the connections. Just before I stopped to do this, I was walking from the lunch area. I got myself a cup of coffee. And I was walking back to the staff rec room. And in between there, there were all the staff accommodations. And for some reason, I stopped instantly in front of room number 22. Uh-huh. Right? I had to research what 22 was after all this happened for me to find out what it meant. It was, the girl who was in there, her name was Allison. And I just saw all is one, 22, all is one. That was in my head as I was hanging myself. Uh-huh. And you know what I was doing? As I hung myself, I was saying, there's no place like home, and clicking my heels.
Nice.
I fuck you not. That's what I was doing.
No, hey. And you're alive. So
Mark, what's that?
Mark, you were. You said you're the happiest that you were in your life. Mm. And even when you were reading down the song there.
Oh, absolutely. Towards the end. I felt like this was a
Right to the very end, you felt like that. Or you had a moment of panic? Or?
This is a good thing. This is a good thing, what you're doing.
Oh, really? Okay.
You're making this fantastic leap, and you're not only going to save yourself, but you're going to save reality itself, was what I literally felt. And the thing of it is, okay, late. Now that sounds like a manic episode, right?
Right.
I mean, it fits all the details of a manic episode. But the thing of it is, I knew that it wasn't because of the authenticity of the experience for me. And it took me years, it took me 6 years before I even started to crack what this was about. And one of the things that I did, because I had no job, right? All I had to do was sit around all day. I'm always looking at media. And then I figured it out. There's a fucking code. I mean, my article Suicide Switch is about this. There is a code in media, and it is a suicide code, and it's a hanging suicide code.
Right.
And it is in the media over and fucking over. I am a Manchurian suicide.
It's true. Basically. It's true. And fucking Christian Bale thing. That's over, right. Over and over and over again with the goddamn hangman.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. There is a – and the sophistication of this code is unbelievable. My article Suicide Switch, which is about probably my favorite movie to watch ever, which is Phantom of the Paradise.
Oh, my God. Dude, what year did that come out?
74.
Okay. It's just okay, so Snor, I need to give you a little bit of context for something. First, I want to say something to your story, Mark, if that's okay, because it's been really important to me, especially recently. I was looking at it was either a commentary on Jung's Red Book or in the Red Book itself, where he was talking about the principle of psychoanalysis. Well, here's my own take on his explanation: is, you know, if you're filming a documentary. And you see a fucking, say you're filming ducks, and there's a duck in oil that's, like, clinging for its life. And
yes.
Technically, if you're a true documentarian, or whatever you call them.
You will not touch the duck.
You will not touch the duck. You do not interfere. And there's something to be said for, like, this is something that also I've seen emphasized with in relation to the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, where you're looking at the yoga practices, where they're, like, basically, you have to be able to be willing to decipher, you say neti neti in Sanskrit. It's not this, not this. And so yeah. Whatever's being put in front of you, no matter how extreme or how overt it seems to be communicating you do your best to remain equanimous to the thing. You're alive. That's why I'm saying nice to there's no place like home, because you're home. Like you're fucking alive. Like you did like, and you're like, we're in Oz. Like, you don't need to go. Like, that's not what over the rainbow means.
No, I know.
And it's a joke. It's a joke that when you're like, you look at the single beam turning to color, turning back to the single beam as a loop on the dark side of the moon, and you're looking at the Wizard of Oz going from black and white into color and back into black and white. You're looking at a loop, and it's your life. It's Valis, right? Yeah. And like, you're fucking here. Like, you did, you know.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, yeah. No, right. You've got it.
And so, just as quickly as I'm able, Snor, before you came on the line, this was something that I went through this whole fucking crazy ass journey just a couple nights ago, looking at the film The Visitor. Are you familiar?
I haven't seen it, no.
Okay, well, that's still fine because you can hear what I'm communicating here without that. So I had this thing where I felt that the film was charged in some way, and that there was something more profound than just the fact that it's a really good film and it's esoteric or whatever. I was like, there's fucking something major about this film. And so I immediately, from there, just was like, what's up with the release date? And like, I look up at the release date and I find that the second largest hotel fire in the U.S. occurred on the date that the film came out. And it was at the MGM Grand Hotel, which is shaped as a giant Mayan pyramid. There was no fire escapes in this building, and it was filled with people. They don't know, ultimately, how the fire started. There's only speculation. All these people died. But what's crazy is that The Visitor comes out on this day, but if you watch... So I'm watching a news broadcast talking about this fire in what is Paradise... Nevada, which is now Las Vegas, right? The director's name of the film, The Stranger, is Michael J. Paradise, is what...
Yeah, I have seen it. This is Stridulum, right?
Yes, Stridulum.
Yeah, okay,
Thank you.
I've seen it. Yeah,
right,
yeah,
and so right. What I'm doing is I'm playing ABBA's album, The Visitors, which came out like a year after this incident happened and the film happened, and it's like fucking... one of the best syncs I've ever found in terms of timing, in terms of meaning, on so many levels. But the thing is if you watch Stridulum, which means hiss or something, one of the opening shots of the film, it says, you know, Atlanta, Georgia. And the film is filmed in Atlanta, and the opening shot of the film actually shows you a hotel that was in this news broadcast. It says this thing at MGM was the second biggest hotel fire in the U.S., but the first was in Atlanta, Georgia. This movie starts out in the aerial shot looking at that hotel in the shot. And then there's a whole thing with fire escapes in that movie. The little girl with telekinesis takes down a fire escape and it drops, and all these people go in a circle around it and are staring down at this fire escape. What the fuck, right? And so I find out that
it's actually pretty incredible. It really is.
Yeah. So the producer of so there was a film that came out during when the first fire happened, the day after. So December. Is it 9th? December 9th, this fire took place in 1947, the one in Atlanta, Georgia. This film,
Bishop's Wife.
The Bishop's Wife, which is about angel intervention, comes out right afterwards. The producer of that film is the G in MGM. He's Samuel Goldwyn. And this is his hotel that burned down. And then the day,
it's 33 years exactly plus one day,
right? It's also and so you have obviously you know, Pearl Harbor Day happening the day of this burn. It's the anniversary of Pearl Harbor, still in the 40s, right?
The 6th anniversary, to be precise,
right? I'm trying to remember what the thing was for. This is a deal. So these two happenings, the opening, this film coming out, The Bishop's Wife, and the fire, bookend December 8th, the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, which is the Rosemary's Baby thing. It's John Lennon's death day. It's Jim Morrison's birthday. It's, you know, it's a sink heavy day.
Is this your birthday as well, is it?
It is actually, it? Yeah.
And
yeah,
my sister's, yeah. My younger sister.
So, it's just basically this is a total mind fuck. I gasped out loud. I couldn't fucking believe it. Going through this whole thing, and then the lyrical content of ABBA's album is like, they're like, cold in this cold December, something along these lines. In cold December, we need to remember the past and the present are tied, and all this kind of stuff. And like, it's talking about fireplace and embers, and in regards to the embers, it's like a slow goodbye. And all this stuff, I'm like, dude, this is what it's fucking talking about. And so, yeah, and obviously Abba is Hebrew for father, which is interesting in its own right, especially in regards to the film, being that it's the demon father who's looking, you know, it's his whole deal. So anyways, yeah, mindfuck city.
It's very interesting. And it's pretty intense, too. It's not just, like, coincidental, because as we were talking about, Znor, like, to me, what this in, you know, this is all archonic to me now. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think of this in terms of either a human conspiracy or even as a Jungian archetypal panoply, or like, I guess, a, what would you call it? A zoetrope, a flashing of these archetypal images as they pass. To me, what it is this. At some point in human history, human beings were made aware that they had to carry out these sacrifices in certain places at certain times. I don't know if you've seen the movie Cabin in the Woods. It's a new film. And the basic idea, it's a parody, it's a mashup. It's, in and of itself, it's a sync film. Because it's all about how every horror movie is like every other horror movie. And what it turns out is that globally there is an awareness that these sacrificial appeasements must take place, or something along the lines of Quetzalcoatl or a Cthulhu-like creature will return and destroy the earth. So, and I mean, to me, this is where I'm at now, is like, this is what is being indicated. This pattern of, this, all The Shining is, it's, you know, I was thinking about, like, in terms of The Shining, and I just sent you guys both each something on your Facebook message, and I would appreciate it if you go to it, because I want to show you something that's going to blow your fucking mind away, quite frankly. It'll only take a minute. So, that there is essentially this, you know, Cthulhu-like system that is certain people are aware of, and it's not even evil humans against less evil humans. It's, there's this necessity of carrying out these archonic sacrifices, otherwise supposedly the entire world gets destroyed. So I don't know if you guys are at your Facebook right now.
Yeah, I'm just looking it up.
Okay, well, don't start. This is a movie called Invitation to Hell. Now, like, I don't know what's on your mind, Znor, what you want to talk about this evening. But I'll make this very quick, because one of my theories, which I talked about on my second to last in the Always Record number 86, one of my theories is that there are three blatant mindfuck films made by Kubrick. I mean, all of his films, we know they're all mindfuck movies, but three of them leave every viewer going, "I have no idea what I just saw." And those three films are 2001, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut. The films don't seem to make any sense. Not only do they not seem to make any sense in terms of what they're presenting, but that they would ever even be released as major films
in the first place.
It is just astonishing.
And film is fucking expensive.
Absolutely.
And for him to be given the freedom to fucking burn through that much fucking film, nobody else.
There's no question about what Kubrick represents, all right? He is the apotheosis of art for a 2,000-year period. And I mean that with dead fucking certainty. He is the hierophant of art, beginning with the crucifixion of Christ and ending with the falling down of the Twin Towers. In my opinion, he was the master of all. And the apotheosis, not necessarily meaning he was there for all of it, that's another matter. But the idea is that when all art comes together into a single place and time, and by the way, Znor, David has made this mashup of Eyes Wide Shut, The Shining, and Full Metal Jacket playing at the same time. It is fucking astonishing.
Really?
The number of degrees of what Kubrick was doing here is insane. It is insane. It shows an imagination that is so fertile that it's like his head is one of those whack-a-mole things, and things are just fucking jumping out of it at every angle all the time with insane accuracy. We could talk about it sometime. I haven't watched the whole thing because it just started to depress me. Basically, how horribly dark it was. But anyway, so let me get back to this whole thing. So you're looking at this thing on YouTube called Invitation to Hell, right?
Yeah.
Well, so now, as I've said in my theory, there are the three obvious mindfuck films of Kubrick. Well, this movie comes out in 1984, okay? And it's a TV movie directed by Wes Craven. And it is a stone cold, and I've already urged both of you to look at this before. And I know what this world is like. You can't expect people to do that, and I don't expect people when I say you should look at this, because life's just too fucking weird.
Actually, Mark, I did see this when you first...
Oh, you did? Okay, all right. Well, then you'll have a little bit of a background on this. This film is an exact mashup of Eyes Wide Shut, The Shining, and 2001. It deals with a guy who works on space-related technologies and spacesuits that can go into places nowhere else can go. No one else can make a spaceship or a spacesuit to go. And it's about how he drives westward with his happy little family through the mountains to take a job with people he doesn't know at this organization, and he immediately gets invited into this Eyes Wide Shut-like country club. So you've got all three films. You've got 2001 Space Exploration. You've got Eyes Wide Shut in regards to the orgies and the weird hyperstructure of the conspiratorial upper group. And then you have The Shining, about a man who was invited out to work at this place somewhere west of where he previously lived. Now, if you play the movie right off the top, the first images are them driving out there. Like, it's pure Shining all over the place. Daddy's driving. Oh, I'm going to my happy new job. All right, well, just to define how intensely close this is, let's go to the 9-minute mark. I've got mine muted right now. You can mute yours, too. I think it's about 9:56. Right, that's Alice looking in the mirror, right? Now, what follows this immediately is Daddy reading to his daughter in bed, and the actress who plays the daughter, her name is Soleil Moon Fry, right? Sun and Moon. Now, as I told you, Znor can back this up without having to watch it. The character of Danny from The Shining is strongly represented in this film. But what I want you to look at now is go to the 14-minute mark. Actually, go to 14 minutes exactly, and then just let it run. This is his first day at work, and guess what he sees, just like Jack Torrance? A secretary squirreling away the Red Book.
Right. I remember this.
Yeah.
Is it actually the Red Book? Does it say it on it?
It's not. It's not.
It's a red file, right?
But yeah. We never find out what's inside that book, but what we know is she doesn't... She doesn't. Yeah. Well, she's Susie, right? She's even got an S on her card. That's Susie from The Shining, right? So this is him coming to The Shining for the interview. That's what's taking place in this scene. And then we jump right into the 2001-y stuff of it almost immediately. But, I mean, it's worth looking at just in terms of these three concepts being linked together very closely.
Sure.
So I just thought it would be kind of neat to share that with both of you guys at the same time. But anyway, so, yeah, I haven't talked to you in a while, Znor, so what's going on in your world?
Well, I wanted to talk with you about nihilism, right?
Which yes, is coming nihilism, yes.
Both of us, right? So you had a big spell of it for a while.
It just ended yesterday. That's the only reason why I'm talking to you right now is because I've been fighting it bad this last little while. Like, the idea of, okay, here I am on Earth. What am I here to do?
Right.
This isn't a suicidal feeling at all. It's more of a, well, what the hell could I be here to do except for to bring about my own death? Right? All other mysteries. And so you might maybe call it fatalism more than nihilism, accurately. But I mean, obviously, the idea of dying would be to achieve nihilism, right? Non-existence. What else could be the point? I mean, to end this horrible torment that, like for me, it came out of nowhere. And I know why I began to feel depressed a few weeks ago. It's because, I don't know if you guys have seen that movie Adaptation
with Nicolas Cage. Yeah.
There's a line in the film where the character played by Chris Cooper, he's talking about how he was once a very devoted surfer. And then one day he just went to the ocean and he looked at it and he turned his back and he walked away and he never surfed a day since. And I have repeated this pattern over and over in my life. And I kind of feel like that was going to happen again with this sort of stuff that we're talking about. Like, I feel like, what am I doing here, you know? And now talking to David, it's really funny because it's like now today, it's like a fucking three of a kind. I haven't talked to anybody in literally months. And now I talk to Alex, my friend Alex Fulton from Oregon, he was the one who introduced me to the movie The Visitor. And then David messaged me to talk to me, and now I'm talking to you on the same day. And it's like, you know, and it's funny because I said to myself, at least from the standpoint of the way I was feeling, which was emotionally so dark and so like, it almost feels like weight. I actually, the way I felt was like, it's like you're a crushed beer can, right? there's no space in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everything is meaningless and finished. And that's just how I was feeling. It's like, what am I doing any of this for? Why do I bother talking to these people? What's it for? Because it just seems to be always leading back into it. But then of course, now I feel like there's some friendship involved here with some people who I'm getting really real with, you know? So
sure.
For me, that's like, it's like the sting in the tail. It's like, oh no, just when I think I'm out, they pull me back in.
Sorry, Mark.
No, that's
hey,
okay.
Hey, Mark, I just saw here, I didn't realize, I've seen the different timings for The Shining and 2001, which all have different versions. But the theatrical version of 2001 is actually 142 minutes long, and apparently there's a version of The Shining that is also 142 minutes.
I would like to see that version.
That's interesting.
And you know, this is the thing. Kubrick is more than that. I mean, just since we're talking about Kubrick, he is the satanic, like, to him, reality is like, if the Easter egg hunt on the White House lawn was run by Asmodeus, that's the reality of Kubrick. I mean, he has filled every single part of his work with so much potential. And, you know, as a business proposition alone, it is the most fucking ingenious thing to do, right? Because people are going to be looking at this guy's movies, and they're hard to find on the old Swedish connection.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, but I mean, there's supposedly that version of The Shining, and The Shining may be the key, right? It's going to be The Shining or Eyes Wide Shut. Because there's obviously the question about whether or not we've actually seen what he really wanted us to see in Eyes Wide Shut.
You know the thing about Bohemian Grove and Eyes Wide Shut?
Mm-hmm.
So the release date deal?
Yeah. No, the real estate deal, no, I don't know.
Okay, so here's the thing. What's that?
I don't know either. I've never
Okay, so check this out. You know, Kubrick was very adamant about the release date of Eyes Wide Shut. I can look it up and see what it is because I don't remember.
Yes, it's July 16th.
Okay, so July 16th. And he wanted it big on the poster. This is like something that's recorded. I found a place where it's like, this is a thing. And it was like, huh.
Yes.
And so apparently, the you know the Alex Jones video where they infiltrate Bohemian Grove? That actually, yes. the director of that film, the guy who's doing that documentary, who hands the camera over to Alex Jones because he's the only person willing to fucking go in there and do this, he is the only person at that point. Okay, so here's the deal. It's hard to go through these kind of lily pad deals, but a year to the day of Eyes Wide Shut's release, that was filmed. The specific day in which it's infiltrated by Alex Jones. The guy who filmed the documentary at that point was, or not at that point, but shortly thereafter, I guess. Anyways, he was the first person to ever be given permission to look at Kubrick's boxes. He was the person who did the documentary, Kubrick's Boxes, was the same guy who fucking filmed Bohemian Grove. You get it?
Huh.
Like, unbelievable.
Yeah.
And that was also July 16th.
Yes.
I know I didn't trust that John Ronson motherfucker. I don't trust that guy.
July 16th is huge, right? Like, that's the day of the Trinity testing and
oh, yeah.
Really? Okay, so here's the deal. Yeah. While we were talking, I looked up the different timings of the Matrix movies just out of curiosity. And the Matrix 1 and the Matrix Reloaded are actually 2 minutes off from each other. But you never know with credits, because sometimes a movie will have longer credits. And I don't know if they're the exact same length, the film themselves. But the Matrix Revolutions is actually within 7 minutes or something like that. And still, I don't know with credits. But that would be an experiment worth running with Trinity. Do you know what I'm saying? Talking about the Matrix from all fucking angles?
Interesting.
I mean, it's an insane activity to do this kind of shit, but I'm drawn to it. And
it does seem kind of insane, but I'm with you. I'm glad that there's somebody else out there that's equally crazy.
The other thing is that right this year, I think it was July 17th, like the day after, was when that plane was shot down in the Ukraine, right? Which was... It's unbelievable anyways, because it's a Malaysian Airlines 777, right?
Shot down
right after July 16th. Right?
Oh, shit. Gotcha. Wow.
Yeah. Oh, no. This whole thing about the plane is that this is a time travel thing, right?
Yeah.
There is the intimation that's being made is that some kind of time vortex is being covered up.
Yeah, either that happened literally or they're trying to make it seem like it happened.
This goes back to what I was saying to you before, Znor, about the idea about the so-called Matrix.
Yeah.
And this idea about how, and I don't know what you guys exactly were talking about, you both had a framework for it, where there's, every angle is being looked at, every single position is being plotted. So if you think of that from the outside in, you can see how that could be used to project a so-called Matrix, where the intelligence of the experience of the Matrix was exterior to the holographic Matrix itself, which is essentially something similar to what you might call like a torture chamber. Particularly as the by the addition of sound, physical sensation and feeling becomes a part of all this as well.
Well, you know the etymology of Matrix, right?
Yeah, mother, matrix. Okay.
It's womb, yeah. Yeah, which is why Neo, when he wakes up, he's in this embryonic stuff, and then he slides down the deal. You know, he's being born.
Yeah. Well, my feelings over the Matrix movies are strong, for sure, too. I'm very interested in what that would look like with the Trinity in those three films.
Hey, I'm sorry. Can I just one more thing really quickly? Because it's awesome. When Neo meets the architect, right? He's given 3 minutes and 14 seconds. Now, most people would think it's just a reference to Pi. This is actually my SyncBook chapter, but it's so awesome I can't help but share it. The geometrical value of Metatron is 314. If you look inside a Tefillin cube at the scroll inside the cube, on the front of it, it says Shaddai, which is the name of God, right? Whose geometrical value is also 314. So you have this association. But when he's introduced, like the architect, Metatron is literally referred to as the architect by Freemasons. Sorry.
Of course.
Wanted to drop that in there.
That's very interesting because the actual image of the Metatron cube.
Yes.
It very much does this kind of thing, is that with all the different crisscrossing lines, it's just basically expressing every way in which information from one point inside the cube could be carried to another point inside the cube. And in a sense, that is the very basis of architecture itself, is that all information is interlocked in such a way that will guarantee, in the case of a Metatron, eternal solidity, right?
That's awesome. It's also 314. is the center of the exact center of Finnegan's Wake. Finnegan's
right.
Wake has 628 pages.
Really? So I've never heard that.
It's the exact same structure, right?
Joyce. Like, what do we think about James Joyce?
Well, yeah, Joyce is...
What the fuck did he do to get where he went?
I don't know. I'm thinking he was some sort of avatar, almost.
Well, I actually think he's an avatar of Oedipus because of his blindness.
Yeah, it could be. Well, see, there's this connection with these myths, right? Oedipus and then Odysseus, which is Ulysses, and the connecting character is Tiresias, right? Who's this blind sage, right?
Okay, all right. I didn't know that.
And yeah, he's. Odysseus goes. He goes into the underworld to meet Tiresias to find out how he gets home. Right?
Mm.
So it's
which then later gets capitalized on by Dante, and that's.
Yeah. Dante places Ulysses in hell because in his final voyage, in his final sea voyage, he. Ulysses ends up going to the mountain of Purgatory on this island in the basically it's in the middle of the Pacific, right? And he tries to storm Purgatory by force, right? Which of course he can't do that, and he ends up there's a big shipwreck, and he ends up dying. But because of that, and because of his whole career, he ends up at the lowest levels of hell.
Wow!
Yeah.
I wish I'd known that before I decided to consciously identify with Ulysses.
That's Dante's take on it, right? It's not necessarily like
no. But that is interesting.
The whole thing is that he denies being no man. Like he claims to be no man, Odysseus, and then right after he betrays the Cyclops. He ends up saying, "I am Odysseus, the son of blah blah blah," and he tells exactly who he is to the Cyclops, right? So he ends up denying that he's no man, right? So he doesn't pass the abyss, right?
Fascinating.
Yeah,
I have no idea.
I have to meditate on that a bit.
Yeah, that's interesting, but that's from the standpoint of Dante.
Not from Dante, like Dante. Dante puts him to hell, right? Like he.
Well, not crossing the abyss is what going to hell would be. So I would say that.
Yeah, I guess.
If you plunge into the abyss and you don't make it, then hell is where you're going.
What Odysseus is, or Ulysses for Dante, is he's an evil counselor, right? He lies in order to achieve power.
I'm liking the slow more and more and more.
Go ahead.
Well, it's important. The only place I've ever seen D'Ott referred to as the abyss is by European occultists, and I don't know of any older source for relating to it as such. In terms of ascending the tree, the Europeans have this kind of way that they relate to that that's pretty unique for them. But I the six directions that are there, where you're like Bina, Chochmah, Gevurah, and Chesed, you know that point is actually that is Metat, that is Metatron. That's how it's related to traditionally by Kabbalists. So it's important to mention that here in this context, being that it ties everything together.
Yes, but that shows the architecture of reality, right? Like above that cube are the three supernals, right?
Right.
Right.
So that's an important point to make a difference of, is that, yes, the Metatron represents, but the Metatron represents the material. Material, matrix, right?
Well Metatron gets replicated into the seven lower sphero, and that's the idea, is that you're actually looking at the whole thing. The tree of life is the star being pulled apart, and out of the gap that exists from it being pulled apart extends Babylon, and that's the empire, and that's why Malkut literally translates as empire. She's the she's the stone that the builders rejected so that they could build the empire that they want to build. So they push this thing out. It's sublimation. And then it's why it necessitates violence. Because if you're sublimating the Shekinah
right.
as Malkut, then everything that extends that's allowing the empire to flourish is violence. Because it's Gevurah, it's 216. That seems to be the premise.
Well, I have something that I think, like, to me, and this, you know, not to beat a dead horse, and that's practically what it is, but this is why I call myself the wrong way wizard, because I think I have this ability to flip things over. And my feeling about this question that you just raised, David, okay, here's what I think. I call this the problem theory, all right? Presumably, all discussions, any kind of, like what we're doing now, even as, like, we're doing it as friends, but we're still discussing problems. That is to say, we are grasping towards a perfect understanding, right? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, therefore, anything within the problem theory is something that is at an inherent deficit. Now, the reason that I'm telling you this is the way that I interpret the abyss, which is also called Deoth, and it's associated with the planet Uranus, right? Or Uranus. So here's my idea. Well, no, because there's an important difference, because Uranus means the sky, and in particular the blue sky, right? Mm-hmm. The open sky, right? So the thing that you would look up to. But Uranus, it's something that goes down. And that this is fitting of an as above, so below principle, right?
Sure.
But here's the thing. I'm proposing this to you guys intellectually as a what if. Because this is something that I just don't hear being talked about, and I believe you're going to at least understand what I'm getting at here, all right? What if that we are living under the illusion of what if the as above, so below principle is what I would call a persistent illusion that is in fact used to distract, like for instance, and I use Uranus and Deoth and the abyss as a way of defining this, okay? So first of all, crossing the abyss must be something that is done as a speculation, all right? Which is to say that anyone who attempts to cross the abyss must do so wondering whether or not they're going to make it. You follow me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, to say that, you're going to cross the abyss, but you know for certain that you will cross it with ease, I find that to be, that's not the abyss type of problem, right? The real abyss is something that is going to at least say to you, you know what, you might not be able to make this.
Right.
You have to know that before you try, okay?
Yeah, like the very point of the abyss is that you are not going to make it, right?
Right.
Well, maybe, but again, to me, that's an as above, so below type of thing, right?
Okay, yeah, you go on then, yeah.
Because we talk about this, as Nor and I, David, we talk, when we chat, we talk a little bit about duality, pluralism, and monadism, the one versus the many or whatever. And to me, this is very critical to this idea, okay? Because there seems to be one of those paradoxical tales that you find, or questions that you find being presented in the movie Labyrinth, right? You know, you have to ask the question, okay, one person's going to lie and another's going to tell the truth.
Oh, yeah, the island thing, yeah.
Yes, and you have only one question you can ask, but you have to get the correct answer. Now, in the case of... So using my logic with a K, I've told you guys both about my logic with a K. So logic with a K, that's my system. Basically, I can't make the leap from L to M. You know, I'm maybe a little bit too afraid to do that. But so in logic with a K, here's how I work this out. So the first thing is that the mere fact that we're having this discussion, now I can relate this to myself as a fact, which is to say I am scared shitless. I have no fucking idea what's going on, but I have a horrible feeling that it has something to do with me. And that is scary stuff, right? You know, and when I say going on, I mean like the big shit. You know, I look around.
Sure, yeah.
Like, for instance, as part of my recovery from my so-called suicide attempt, I considered tearing my eyes out of my head because what I was seeing was so intense that I thought, I cannot look at this. I can't. I'd be much happier if I did. And then it wasn't even until later when I saw Pasolini's Oedipus that I actually knew that Oedipus had torn his eyes up. So that was kind of interesting. And furthermore, there was a lightning path kind of thing in that for me. Because when I was a kid and I used to get depressed, I've always worn glasses since I was about 10 years old. And when I was a kid, when I would get very depressed, I would break my glasses on purpose. Uh-huh. And just as an interesting anecdote, when I went to see the movie They Live, I had previously broken my glasses in a fit of depression, so I had to wear my prescription sunglasses. I shit you not. I went into it was a nearly full theater, and I went into the movie They Live wearing these fucking Ray-Bans, basically, totally black. So I thought that was kind of funny. But anyway, so what we have then here, which I'm relating to you personably, because that's where I come from as a matter of fact to me, is like, this is scary. What does it really mean? Is it calling upon me to act? Is there some type of ritual I'm not performing properly? Is there any number of things that I'm supposed to do? And, you know, in Hebraic, in the Jewish mysticism, they have tekun olam, right? Like, this is what human beings are here to do. We're supposed to repair the universe. That's what tekun olam means. It means to make a repair to the damage done because of the fall, right?
Right, right.
So the mere fact then, in my logical system, that we are discussing things from the position of a problem indicates that we are at a deficit. Okay? So therefore now we can interpret supposed proper interpretations as very simple sleight of hand or essentially what I would call reverse psychology, right?
Right.
What if it is truly not what is as above, so below? What if there is no below? What if there is no above? And that this system of this dualistic and reflexive system actually somehow separates us from a greater truth, as opposed to being a system like you know, David, you know the numbers, and I love this kind of number stuff. Like, I'm studying the Hebrew letters as you are. I don't think in the same way, by far. My technique is a little bit different, but right now, like, I'm working my way through the. I just got to Kuf, basically, or Kof, whatever you call it.
Kuf.
And my reasons for that are quite fascinating, but that's another matter. So, you know, and by the way, it's interesting because right now when you look at Africa, the part of Africa that is troubled by Ebola is the back of the head, right? Because they wear the Rosh Tefillin, which is the head Tefillin, they wear that in the position that Jerusalem takes on the continent of Africa. If you look at the profile of the continent of Africa, you will see it's a human skull.
Uh-huh. Right.
And the position of the Rosh Tefillin, or the Resh, depending upon whether you're Ashkenazic or Sephardic, but the Resh Tefillin sits in the position of Jerusalem, exactly where Jerusalem would be if you saw Africa as a human skull. Okay. Well, right now, the Ebola outbreak is taking place in the back of the head, or the skull. The back of the skull, the behind the ears. And that's what Kuf means. It's the part of the skull that's behind the ears. So Kuf is, and Kuf is interestingly enough what I'm studying right now.
Yeah, I every time I see the sun and the moon in tarot, and I see Kuf and Resh, you know, the front of the head and the back of the head, I can't help but relate to that as communicating something about the medial brain. Being that Keter in the when I look at the commentary I look at on the Zohar, and the Zohar itself from Aramaic, the way that Keter is translated is literally the medial brain.
Right now there's something pretty phenomenal going on in the Kuf territory.
Yeah, I mean, it's just this whole idea of the pineal and the pituitary, the way that they relate to each other is the sun and the moon, seems to have some significance there. I don't know.
Well, and then to me, all of this relates automatically to the Ebola outbreak in the skull of Africa.
Yeah, you can feel it when you put on a tefillin strap because you because you have the cube on the, resting on the front of your head at the pituitary, but there's a knot in the back that they actually liken to the letter Dalet, in the way that the two straps hang down. That's a very significant thing for them, the way they spiral. And so beard, you know, I forget what they call those. It's like tzitzit, but the spiraling, and you're literally spiraling the tefillin cube around your arm using chesed to gevura. So you're taking gevura and you're enwrapping it with the strap, which is actually said to be symbolic of a serpent. And then you're doing seven rounds down your forearm, and then you're doing three rounds down your Saturn finger. So, you know, you have your Jupiter finger as your pointing finger, and this is true even with Kabbalah way back when you're relating to palmistry. So for the middle finger, you're tying three loops around it, and then you bring it back around your forearm and you tie it all together. But that is actually said to relate to Malkut. And so what's interesting, too, is that, like, on the Tree of Life, Malkut used to be related to Saturn and Yesod to Jupiter, which shifted in Europe. But traditionally, that seems to be like, from what I gather, a kind of a consensus agreement amongst traditional Kabbalists. And so it's also that you have the seven lower spherot going down your forearm, and then you have the supernal triad enwrapping Saturn. It's like rings around Saturn, literally.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. Laterally, you know.
However, the position of Saturn, because Saturn is in the position of, what is it? It's Keter, then Bina, then Chesed?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Saturn is generally...
Oh, I'm sorry. You're saying Chokhmah to the left of Bina?
It was a Chokhmah.
Oh, I mean, I strike that, reverse it. It gets confusing. But yeah, no, you go Keter to Chokhmah to Bina.
Okay, then, so it's Bina then. So Saturn is usually in the Bina position, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but for the ritual of the pendant, of the hexagram, Saturn is moved down into the position of Deoth, right? In other words, it is used to block the abyss itself.
Right. Though it's interesting that it seems to be that the lowering of the supernal triad into the seven lower spherot is they didn't relate to symbols in the same way. Like, there's things that they just did, and they weren't like backing up to objectify like we're doing when we're analyzing things.
Well,
when you bow your head in prayer, that action is actually because you want to be receptive. So like just like the Aramaic word for purge. Is the same word for salvation or atonement. You know, it's this idea that you're humbling yourself before, you know, the penitent man shall pass, you know.
I lost you guys.
But here's my thing on this.
Oh, you lost us? Is that what you said?
Snorri, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Can you hear us?
Ah, my speakers are just like...
It's probably it's the NSA. They heard some code words in there.
Probably, once you throw a Bina in there, they want to know.
Here we go, okay.
Because plebes like us aren't supposed to get above Yod.
Right.
Or yes.
You're on the moon, yes, you're on the moon, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead, where are we at?
Mark, I was wondering, you said before that you were connecting that with Uranus, right? Where does that come from?
Well, being the abyss, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's a good. I mean, I know that I've seen it. I just don't know where it's from because I
No, it's interesting. Like I've heard it being connected with Sirius, right? Like some of the I forget what this guy's name is. He was a student of Dion Fortune, right? Like the whole sort of Golden Dawn tradition. But he's sort of a contemporary astrologer now, right? Really well known. But
yes,
he connects. He connects that with Sirius, right?
Well, okay, now that's interesting. That's, you know, I don't agree with that. I really don't.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell you why. And, you know, this is funny because I feel very, it's so exciting to talk to people and challenge these fucking principles, basically, where people, oh, you can't challenge, you know, Dion Fortune. Or I talk to people like this sometimes. Well, okay, give me a break. All right, to me, this is why that doesn't make sense, okay? Because, okay, here's, first of all, the way in which I've developed my principle of Sirius is that it represents what I'm calling the limit of the perceptual matrix, particularly in regards to imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in regards to imagery. It's only relatable in regards to sound and sensation in regards to a pretty massive historical curve. You have to be very advanced because of the size of Sirius, right? Mm-hmm. Now, this is one of the things about the whole hocus pocus about science gets in the way a lot here, all right? To me, the model that we're talking about is this. We have the perceptual, all right, we have Yesod, which is the moon. Now, that's number 9, right? Now, I'm not going to talk about Keter or Chokhmah or Bina. Man, I really need to be, by the way, just for the record, I am the Dr. Venkman of Sync.
Dr. Venkman and Mr. Hyde, more like it.
No, because I never study. I am a bad, bad student. I'm the worst. But the fact is I feel very strongly that I might be onto something here. So I want to, and just let me just very quickly, before I go into this, I want to touch on the idea that I was getting at before about this idea that as we are discussing, as we are, and I mean, you know, reject or not, accept or deny, figure out something new or don't figure it out. The fact of the matter is that all of these principles, no matter how open-minded you might be, indicate that you yourself are at some kind of a deficit. There's always a question that remains. And my theory about questions that continue to remain is this, that in the absence of remaining, or in the presence of a remaining question, every single principle may be considered to be at least potentially also its total opposite. Mm-hmm. Right? Sure. Particularly in the, and this is just simple. It's such simple logic. This is this is why, you know, say for instance, transhumanism. I mean, I'm a very fucking humanistic person. You know, this is why part of the world, reason the world is scary to me. One of my a person that I know, I very rarely see this person because he works with my mother, but he is a transgender. And I actually gave him his male name. I gave the suggestion, and he ended up picking it. And I was one of the people who said, you know, this person is a legitimate transgender, okay? But on the other hand, I'm like, fuck, this is kind of weird, right? You know? Like, hey, guess what? The government is now going to pay for you to have a penis? You know, to me, it's like I can't separate these two things. Not that I can't separate them. I can't quite reconcile them. Like being a humanistic person and caring about other people doesn't mean that you necessarily don't see that there are some problems in the way in which our system works. And this is one of the things that is problematic, I think, about thought in general. And I think it's very problematic about the school of sync. And only in the last little while have I been able to articulate this in this way. You know, and I'm not going to bother writing an article about it, but this is kind of what I'm getting at. And I'm glad that you guys understand this. Because the whole idea that we're having an argument about maybe it could be this or that indicates that at the very limit of possibilities, it's logical to imagine that we're completely fucking wrong about everything. And that everything we consider positive could be kind of a reverse psychology.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Right? Now, I want to talk about what I want to talk about now is the ritual of the hexagram. Are you guys familiar with this?
Yeah.
Okay, because the ritual of the hexagram, this is very important because the hexagram is a positive and a negative triangle, right? And the ritual of the hexagram is a golden dawn ritual. All right, they invented it. And the idea of this is that the influence of the Bina, which is Saturn, is brought into a position that is hexagonal. Now, I've never read I've never come across anything that brings either Chachma or Keter any line across, you know, the Empress, basically. That line. It never goes into the lower Sephiroth. As far as I know. But Bina does in the ritual of the hexagram. So what Bina does is it cranks itself down, covering Uranus, covering Deot, right? And in the tree of life that I'm looking at right now, and I see many of them here. There's some of them that are quite classical. I'm looking at, you have the abyss, and then Deot, the house, the so-called forbidden 11th Sephiroth, is represented by the planet Uranus or Uranus, okay? Mm-hmm. So here's what I'm trying to get at. All right, so what you have is now you have the ritual of the hexagram, which supposedly balances matrixical forces. This is what's very important, right? It's the male and the female in balance. There has to be something because the shape of the tree of life, if you take off the upper Sephiroth, which are the supernals, the three houses at the top, what you have is essentially something that is screaming out to be a hexagram, and then beneath it is something that is screaming out to be the pendulum on a clock, right? Mm-hmm. That is Malkut, right? The 10th house, which we call kingdom. You call it, what did you call it?
Well, you can say empire.
Empire works fine too. I don't have a problem with that because that indicates the actual dialectic, right? The Hegelian dialectic. If you see Malkut as something that swings from side to side, like the pendulum of a grandfather clock, you can see how that's very representative of the material world. The world in which we're living in, material, there's always one question. It's like that, and this is what I think that Kubrick's getting at with ping pong and tennis and boxing, right? Back and forth. One, it's a constant cybernetic shuttling. The question itself never resides in a single place in the empire. It's always being moved in the sense of an argument.
Yeah, she's the queen.
Okay, well, yes, that too, and that has a lot to do with the so-called dualism of the female, right?
Right. She can go anywhere. She's the only spherot that it can move anywhere on the tree.
Yes, but let me. Okay, since you brought up the dualism,
awesome.
See,
yeah.
So she. Okay. See, this is a tough one because if you're saying that Malkut is the queen, and I represent Malkut as dualism in action,
I just mean that specifically in regards to chess.
That's okay, what I'm communicating. Can go anywhere. Yeah. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
Am I going on too long here?
No, keep going.
No, you're fine. Yeah, do your thing. Okay, man.
I'm very close to getting to my point here.
Okay.
All right, so what you have, so forgetting the upper three then, you have this thing that, and the clock, of course, is broken into six sections, right? 60 minutes, groups of 10, whatever. You can call it groups of 12. But, you know, the number six is something that is, springs out of a clock.
Sure.
Right, okay. So you have your six positions then that would be defined by the lower houses, including day off, all right, which we perceive as a forbidden house, all right? Now, what happens is, and this is my opinion, and I don't know where this comes from. I mean, to me, like, we're fuck, this is so exciting because I feel like I'm sharing you, like, Crowley-level shit with you people here, all right? And I know that you get it, even if you disagree. So what happens then is in the ritual of the hexagram, you bring Saturn, which sits normally at the position of Bina, mm-hmm. you bring it into the so-called forbidden or 11th position, and this creates a clock. Now, what is the purpose of the ritual of the hexagram? Well, if you look at it, it's very simple. Because what it does is that you, as the ritual exerciser, stand in the position of Tifereth, right? So you're at the center of the clock. Mm. And when you bring Bina in on top of Day-Off, now creating a legitimately a material hexagram, because in terms of the house, if you recognize, in terms of the Sephirot, if you say clearly that Day-Off is Uranus and that Day-Off is also the abyss, then this is why it's always drawn with a dotted line or something like that, or forbidden. It's because it's not actually there, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that when you bring Saturn, which is normally in the position of Bina, into the position of this magical place where something doesn't exist, now you have an actual material hexagram, right? Are you with me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Prior to that ritual, or prior to that motion, the hexagram would be open at the top. It would almost be like that guy in Brazil, the poster, you know, with his face is nothing, but what's exploding out of his brain is magnificent, right? In the poster of Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Oh, so, yeah.
What I'm getting at is this. So let's say then that the matrix or the material world is what is created when the solid position of Saturn is brought into the position of Day-Off. And this creates then the balanced chronological universe. And make no mistake about it, the very position, the reason to do the ritual of the hexagram is clearly outlined. You might have to do some digging, but I will stand by this on my very soul. To place, and I mean it, honestly, I got no problem with that because I know what I'm saying is there. I mean, I'm just a bad researcher, but I got a fucking memory like a steel trap.
Sure.
And what you're supposed to do with the ritual of the hexagram is it is supposed to place the aspirant, the student, the Freemason, the member of the Golden Dawn, in a position at the center of the solar orrery. So now you are where the sun is. You stand in the position of the sun, and at the center you can now see Saturn and Jupiter, Mars, Mercury, Venus, and the moon moving around you, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. Earth itself doesn't move around you. It's the pendulum on the clock.
Hey,
right?
Don't you find it interesting that that between Chesed and Gevurah you have the strength card? If you're looking at the tree as like the lightning flash, then you add up the pathways as they're presented by the Europeans, you have 777. It seems as though strength, which is the translation of Oz, whose value is 77. Right. I've said this before, but I just find it really interesting that it seems as though strength is what's holding the pillars up. And that it's like Oz is holding the pillars up, and that's actually like the that's the point of the rainbow where you're going from the black and white above.
Absolutely. I'll tell you why you're dead on the money. You're dead on the money because if you think of Oz being the ram, right? Mm-hmm. And then each pillar becomes a horn of the ram. And the pillar, mm-hmm. of course, is representative of the Phi, or the Phi, people call it Phi, you know, the golden spiral, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that golden spiral creates this perpetual state in which we are living in, where certain functions are continually framed on what appears to be a minuscule scale, but when you move in closer, they have the exact same proportions as your reality. And this is over, and this is so-called the, you know, as I've described it, Zeno's paradox, where there's always yet another way of dividing up the principle. One more. There's always one more question in between you and the final question.
Right.
And this works exactly in terms of what you're saying, David, if we represent that strength, and think of the strength, that, and I also believe that this strongly identifies with the female, right? just between us three guys, for whatever it's worth, to me, women are like these much stronger than men. And furthermore,
I agree. Furthermore,
women can maintain dualism with a level of joie de vie that is fucking terrifying to me. I'm serious. I mean, all the horrors of Kafka can be summed up in the daily behavior of your average woman.
Well said, yeah.
In my opinion. And, you know, you can't, just like Jack says, you can't hate them for it. Or, I mean, Jack doesn't exactly say that, but I'm not sure whether it's a live without them or live them without. And this is my final point, and that is that maybe this ritual, maybe the actual, there is a material value to the position of Uranus at Deoth. And I believe that this has to do with what, I believe that it is potential, using my kind of logical sense that everything could be exactly opposite of what we think it is. That this idea of Uranus, which originally means the blue sky, right, into which principles can leap freely, and yet which the human being is rooted in the world, has their feet on the earth, right? Because this is what happens when Saturn comes in over that, it becomes a clock and it just starts going round and round. It's like, every, you know, every morning when the alarm rings, that's the first punch in the face that you get. And then you keep getting these time-related punches all the day. You know, they punch your clock, right? You know, but if you remove Saturn back to its original and proper position of being and never bring it in, completely eschewing the ritual of the hexagram, what you then have is a position where the material five-pointed world represented by Mars, Jupiter, Mercury, and the Moon, right? And the Sun. So that actually would be six. Is that right? Six? Yes, it would be six. And that makes sense in the human being because you have the Vitruvian man, the head, and then the seventh place would be the open third eye as opposed to being the clocked third eye, which is what happens when you bring in this so-called balanced system. So I'm saying that to me, right now, that this is kind of representative of what I'm talking about, this kind of fallacy where you have as above, so below, but maybe the true principle is that there is no above.
Right, that's kind of...
Simultaneity, right?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Znor?
Simultaneity, yeah.
I don't know if I call it simultaneity. I guess I would say that it's a place where the mind is truly free, but the material world continues to exist. So you're right. Yeah, simultaneity. There you go.
So it kind of has a narcissist quality to it. If he's looking at his reflection, but he's made of water.
Not exactly, no. I don't think it has a necessary... Well, maybe it does.
I mean, in terms of that narcissist himself is filled with water. We're all just hairy bags of water, and he's staring down looking at his reflection.
I was thinking about that. Yes, I was thinking about that, David, and I'm with you. I get what you're getting at, but what if it's not narcissism? What if it's baptism?
Right, but narcissists, the way that we use the term narcissist isn't necessarily like what the myth is conveying.
Narcissism becoming baptism, that's excellent. Like, narcissism jumps into the water, right?
That's right.
Dig it.
So anyway, you know, I've said my bit, guys. I mean,
no, hey, that was awesome. Thank you.
So that's just my feeling about this, is that there's at least a possibility that everything that we are being told is actually negative or abysmal is actually the goal itself, right?
Yeah, there's that idea that the shadow is what we're like. So when I was in Shasta at this abbey and I was hanging out with these monks, they were talking about how the Buddha doesn't go into the light, that everybody goes into the light. And we say the thing like, oh, go into the light. And it's like the light is rebirth. It's like the birth canal, right? I mean, they didn't say that, but it's that principle that they're saying you turn around to the darkness because there is no darkness. And that's the whole point, is that we're afraid of what's behind us, thinking that, you know, and it's like why, like, you know, God covers the eyes of Moses so that all he can see is his back parts as he passes by him. So
right.
he never see, he all he can see is the shadow.